You're listening to CKLN 88.1 FM. We're joined now by Kim Pate, who is the Executive Director of the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies, an organization that works with and on behalf of women who are in conflict with the law. Hi, Kim. Welcome to the show.
Thank you, Antonia.
You've written that involvement in the criminal justice system is more indicative of the extent to which one is marginalized than it is of one's criminality. Can you tell us about the increased criminalization of women?
Sure. I think, you know, one of the things we're seeing is, it, not just in Canada but internationally, one of the fastest growing prison populations is women, and we're increasingly seeing women criminalized for a variety of things that are absolutely linked to some of the global phenomena we're seeing in terms of cuts to social programs, cuts to education, cuts to health care. And how that happens principally is, for when we look at the women who are ending up being criminalized, one of the fastest growing groups is women who have mental and cognitive disabilities. So women who previously may have been labeled as mentally handicapped, or we've got one woman who's old enough that she was initially labeled mentally retarded. So as she's been moved through the system, what's happened to her, I think, is a good example of where we've seen some progressive movements that were about deinstitutionalizing people, and movements where women were initially overrepresented. So particularly when we talk about women with mental health labels, those women have often been overrepresented in psychiatric and mental health institutions. So as we saw the deinstitutionalizing of those movements, we saw some, you know, movement of many women into the community. Those who couldn't be managed in the community often ended up being institutionalized in psychiatric hospitals. And then when we had deficit dementia hit, what we saw is those otherwise, you know, at least liberal or progressive movements end up being thwarted, and services that were available in the community were literally stripped away, and people fell into the streets. And, of course, the system that can't say no and can't just say we don't have any more money is the criminal justice or injustice system. And so what we've seen is those women, as well as men and young people, who have ended up falling through the very drafty social not safe net anymore, have ended up being captured by the deepest, widest, stickiest net of social control we have, and that's the criminal justice system. And once they're in there, it's very hard to extricate themselves, because the whatever behavior they have when they go into the institution, especially if they're going into a federal institution, they end up often being labeled as higher security, because not because they're necessarily a danger to anybody else but themselves, but because they are hard to manage. And so one of the three ways that they can be labeled high security in the federal system is, one is obviously the offense that's committed. Second is what risk you'd be to escape, and what risk you'd be in the community if you did escape. And the third, and the way that most women end up being labeled high security, is their institutional adjustment or their ability to be managed in the prison. So you can appreciate that anybody who's been in institutions for a long time, especially if they're individuals who are seen as very emotional, they'll be seen by an institution that's based on, you know, fairly clear methods of power control is really difficult to manage. So we're seeing not only the increased criminalization of women with mental and cognitive disabilities, but we're also seeing them being housed in some of the most secure and isolating and brutalizing environments. And so they're, whatever condition, and I hesitate to use some of the labels that get attached to them, but the whatever condition they have ends up being exacerbated, or often we see women acquiring mental health labels because they're housed in psychiatric, housed in segregation conditions. So that's one area we're seeing. Another is, as we've seen the cutbacks to social assistance and welfare across the country, what we're seeing is women who basically just can't make it on the money that's provided, and I think many of us would argue that's long been the case, but it's even worse now with all of the cutbacks. And we see women increasingly, you know, taking a job, working under the table, sometimes sex trade, sometimes they'll be involved in, you know, they'll be offered the opportunity to carry a package across the border and make more money than they can make in a year. And so they'll take those opportunities. Other times it'll be one of their kids' birthdays or some other holiday that they want to provide a gift for, or the kid's going to a birthday party and they'll risk going in and being caught shoplifting. And so we see women for what is really survival, economic survival, and support of themselves and their children often, because they're often the sole supports of those children, ending up being criminalized for what is really them attempting to survive economically. Another area we see is, as we've seen, one of the horrible backlashes to the increased focus on violence against women is that we've seen things like zero tolerance policies, and there's a whole other story we could have about the impact of zero tolerance on young people. But if we talk about women, what that's meant is, instead of having a gender-specific response to violence against women, what's ended up happening is gender-neutral policies. And in fact, they're not gender-neutral, but what happens is the police may arrive, and if the woman has in any way managed to use any kind of force or issue a defensive blow, she'll likely end up being charged as well. In some cases, only the woman being charged. We've got a couple of cases that were, well, more than a couple, but a couple that we're actually, you know, trying to assist the women in fighting right now. The women were the ones who called. They had been in abusive relationships that were known to the police. When they called the police and the police came, the partner indicated that, you know, he had scratches or had been hit by a plate, or those are the cases that I'm talking about now. But, you know, she would say, well, he was beating on me, and there's no visible mark on her body that the police officer can see. And we've had a couple of cases where those women have ended up being the only ones charged. So we've seen the flip of that. We're also seeing the increased criminalization of women's allies and advocates through things like looking in sexual assault cases. If a rape crisis center or shelter is not willing to provide records of the complainant, to provide them to the defense counsel so they can be, you know, cross-examined and basically put on trial themselves, have their allegations put on trial, then we've seen those women being charged with contempt. And I was just with an ally, a woman who's also a lawyer in Australia, who just saw the next stage, I fear, that we're going to see here as well, which is women and men who are allies and activists being criminalized for intervening. In this case, we were intervening in a case of an Aboriginal man being jacked up on the street, and she was charged with two charges of hindering police as a result of our intervention. So, you know, we're seeing increasingly the focus on really decriminalizing some of the very behavior that the state sanctions and criminalizing, increasingly criminalizing women and young people and men who are most marginalized.
Aboriginal women and women of color are extremely overrepresented in the criminal and justice system. Can you talk about this?
We're seeing now a situation where corrections themselves identifies that 44% of the women who are serving 2 years or more are Aboriginal women or women of color. 23% are Aboriginal, and that's just based on their report. So, and we've seen an increased number of African Canadian Black women, and increasing number of Asian women coming into prison. And there's no doubt that, especially when we look at the representation that they are of the Canadian population, or the population in Canada, that they're vastly, vastly overrepresented. And again, Aboriginal women are almost half of the Aboriginal women who are in custody will be labeled as higher security. Many of them will also end up having mental health labels attached to them and end up living in isolation. So even though we've got the Okemoche Healing Lodge, which was designed with for Aboriginal women and involved a number of women from the community, only approximately half of the women can actually get there, and most of the women it was actually built for are still in these segregated max units. And of course, these are women who often have resisted not just their multiple layers of institutionalizing and colonization, but also have, you know, their families, many generations of colonization and institutionalization, first in residential schools, then often into youth child welfare situations, then into the juvenile justice or injustice system, and then into the adult system. And, you know, our fear is that even though now in Canada there's been this lip service paid in throne speech to decarcerating Aboriginal peoples, our very major concern is at the same time we're hearing people starting to talk more and more about FAS and FAE, fetal alcohol syndrome and fetal alcohol effect. And there's no doubt that there's a race, it's a racialized discussion. And our fear is that even if we saw a concerted effort on the part of our government to, or governments, to try and decrease the number of Aboriginal women being criminalized, the reality is that what we'd see is most of those people then being labeled as in need of treatment, and that would be the next layer of institutionalizing and colonizing the experiences of the Aboriginal people, because we're already seeing that being applied to young people, and increasingly we're fearful that that will be the tack that will be taken with, so it'll be a benevolent, patriarchal approach that often then also becomes even harder to challenge. So the more we see people living and pushed to the margins and treated as human refuse, the more likely we're going to see them jettisoned into the criminal justice system and particularly into our prisons.
I understand that with the Healing Lodge, there was, as you've said, a lot of lip service paid to the fact that it would be a part of the First Nations communities, and that increasingly Corrections Service of Canada is taking more and more control away.
That's right. I mean, one of the challenges has really been for the Nikanik Reserve is one of the few reserves that hasn't been as touched by, for instance, they don't have a church, and so they didn't have the same impact of Christianity and the resulting devastation that brought to Aboriginal peoples. But what they did was they made a commitment to support the women and eventually take over the lodge. And instead of seeing more and more of what was really excellent about the lodge when it first opened, and what I mean by that is that it was still a prison, and I don't mean that I support it as a prison, but it was one of the few places you could go. In fact, the only place I've ever gone where, aside from the women I knew, I really could not tell in the early days who were women, who were prisoners, who were staff, and who were visitors. Because what they had done is actively recruit people from the community. So women with the lived experience themselves, some of whom had had records themselves, some of whom had lived on the street or worked the streets, who had dealt with their own histories of abuse. 90% of the Aboriginal women, 82% of the women overall, have histories of physical and or sexual abuse who are in the system. So women who had dealt with in their own lives, and we're often still dealing with the impact of colonization and institutionalization and the resulting coping of medicalizing and using medical ways of basically coping, whether it's drugs or alcohol, were hired and actually went through significant training. And the training, I think one of the most challenging and interesting and important parts of the training from their perspective and ours is, and certainly from the women who they then were charged with guarding, was that they actually had to go through treatment programs as, quote, clients, so that they would understand what it was like to be in someone's institutional control if they'd forgotten, and have someone have absolutely control over everything they said and did, including when they ate and slept and all the rest of it. And that seemed to have a very powerful impact on the types of relationships they then wanted to have with the women they were working with. And so they also then developed programs and services that the women requested and built them around the needs as identified by the women. So women were going out into the community to see their kids, their kids were coming in to see them, they were going out for job training, they were going out even for medical appointments into the community as opposed to having institutional doctors and that sort of thing set up in the lodge. So that was really positive. And unfortunately, it didn't seem as much like a prison as the others, and that often makes corrections nervous, so they started imposing more and more security practices, and we've seen, unfortunately, an erosion of those original principles. And some of the, as I say, some of the same women who it was built for have never been able to get there. But there is a new warden, or Kikawa now, which is Cree for our mother, and it was a term that was picked by the Aboriginal women to designate the wardens. You see a very different starting point in terms of the relationship they think they should have with her. And we have, hopes that certainly she and the Vision Circle, the Kikawin Kanawak that works with her, are going to actually reinstill some of what has been lost and actually build it towards being a place that women actually are going into, but more importantly are coming out into the community and being, having a better base to be established and have some resources so that they're not So I'm just stuck with no other place to go but back in.
We're going to take a short break now, but stay tuned. We're talking with Kim Pate from the Elizabeth Fry Society. You're listening to Prisoners Justice Day Radio on CKLN 88.1 FM. We're talking now with Kim Pate, who is the Executive Director at the Canadian Association of Elizabeth Fry Societies. We're talking about women in prison. I'd like to ask you to talk about the abuses that took place at the prison for women. Have things changed at all since the Arbor Report and the new regional prisons?
In some ways, I mean, sometimes it depends on the day. I'll say, you know, we've taken two steps forward and one back, or one forward and two back. The new regional prisons physically are better, but as the women will very aptly point out, that a nice prison and pink walls doesn't change the environment if you've still got staff who have no interest in anything but having absolute power and control over you and humiliating you and degrading you at every instant. Now, there have been certainly some excellent staff hired in the new places, women who used to work in rape crisis centers, shelters, and halfway houses, who've gone in. Unfortunately, a lot of them have also left because what they were then trained to do by the correctional services to be guards and not to provide the kind of support that they were, and services that they were hoping they'd be hired to do for and provide for the women. So we've got, on the one hand, some women being closer to home, some women aren't, because particularly the Aboriginal women from Manitoba, for instance, were actually closer to home when, you know, ironically, when they were at prison for women than they are if they're sent to the Edmonton Institution or the Okemoche Healing Lodge. So there's some real challenges still there, but they are being brought closer to home. But then we have these segregated maximum security units which have been set up and house the women in four male institutions. And so women are increasingly isolated and living in basically segregated conditions. And so, you know, for those women, it's been a huge step backwards because it's the worst of what they experienced at prison for women. And we've had, since the Arbor Report, which is almost 5 years old now, it'll be 5 years old on April 1st, we've had still had reports of and investigations into women being stripped inappropriately, you know, stripped. Well, personally, I think it's never appropriate, but and our organization has that position. It has a position against strip searching and segregation and the like, but women have been strip searched outside the law, where the policy says it's permissible. There's been routine mandatory strip searching in some institutions. We've seen women still stripped in the presence of men, even though that's supposed to be against policy and against the law. We've seen women denied lawyers' calls. We've seen in one of the units routinely a practice that was going on was on Friday afternoons, particularly on long weekends, women and men for that matter as well, being designated as individuals who should be reviewed as to whether they were competent under the Mental Health Act, and then just so that the institution could keep them locked all weekend, and then at the end of the weekend, being released. And the competency proceedings being abandoned. So, I mean, we've had a number of horrible incidents of abuse, not to mention the women slashing since the new prisons opened. One woman killed in one of the institutions, and several women fleeing the institutions. And so we've had, you know, a lot of indication that, and usually what we see is as tensions arise and as staff turnover happens, as there's a lack of any kind of intervention or support for the women in the institutions, what we first see and what we've seen in a number of the institutions is an increase in self-injurious behavior, so women starting to slash, attempt suicide, burn themselves, smash their heads, that sort of thing, and swallow razor blades and things. That we first see that self-injurious component, and then starting to, in desperation, some will start to flail out against each other and against the staff. And so the Saskatchewan Penitentiary Unit in particular has been There's one where the women have been extremely isolated. You know, there have been up to 18, 19 women from time to time, but separated into six or seven different small units, sometimes only one or two on one floor at a time, and with minimal staff, no extra staff for them to deal with the needs of all those women. And not surprisingly, we've seen those women start to strike out against themselves and then start to, in frustration, to challenge each other, because, of course, if there's one elder, and there most of the women are Aboriginal, and you know, she's got to go to seven different areas to see the women. Some get seen first, some don't, and so that, you know, in basically creates friction between the women, and that gets built upon often by the treatment staff or poked at by the staff, and then they start to react not only against each other but against the staff. So we've seen some really horrendous examples of what can happen when you put people in that kind of brutalizing and degrading environment.
Mm-hmm. And talking about women who self-injure, the system also takes really punitive actions against that, claiming that those women will be more violent.
Mm-hmm.
But
that's right. Well, a couple of years ago, there was some. In fact, it was during the Arbour Inquiry. Research was presented by Corrections that showed there was a link between women's self-injurious behavior and suicidal behavior, and their likelihood of being violent again. Now, CSC, interestingly, is now saying that they're moving away from that position. They've been challenged so much about it, but still, in their classification scheme, it's there that if a woman has a history of self-injurious behavior, has a history of being abused by, let's say, a partner, or it has suffered child abuse, then the reality is that she's placed at a higher risk level of being violent to other people, even though the reality is, obviously, that there is no link. I mean, the only link you can find is if you look at women who have been criminalized and are placed in the federal prison system, about half of them are in there for what are deemed violent offenses, never mind that they may be, you know, relatively minor assaults, and I don't mean to minimize any kind of violence, but the reality is that most of them are not in for predatory offenses, and in fact, you can count on one hand the number of cases that involve any kind of what could even be referred to as predatory violence. And so in most of the cases, they're reacting to violence themselves, often defensively, and yet because they have this group of women who are labeled violent by the system, and then they study those women, given the reality that we have 90% of Aboriginal women, 82% of all women having histories of physical and or sexual abuse, given the linkages we know between histories of abuse and self-injurious behavior, I mean, how could they not, if they only looked at women in prison, not find some correlation? However, if you then compare to women outside of prison, the number of women who have suffered violence and may self-injure but haven't been criminalized, obviously you see there's absolutely no link between the two, and yet they've made that link. And officially their policy is now that women cannot, or prisoners cannot, be segregated or punished for self-injurious behavior. The reality is they still get segregated. It's not classified as punishment anymore. It's classified as a need to observe them or need to ensure they have psychiatric care. So we have this horrible situation of, you know, in some cases, a woman will be put in what's referred to as intensive psychiatric care, and what it really is segregation with chemical restraints. They're basically drugged. And so, you know, that's been, unfortunately, the reality in a number of the institutions. Not all, but in where it's not happening, it generally is because there's a very strong peer support element where women are assisting each other, and unfortunately often they're hiding when they're slashing and supporting each other so that they don't end up, you know, incurring the wrath of the administration.